The court. This appeal involves two procedural issues related to Mr. Musazadeh's lawsuit against TDCJ, requesting that it provide him kosher food for the duration of his time in custody. First, whether Mr. Musazadeh, after properly exhausting his administrative remedies before filing suit, is nevertheless required to re-exhaust those remedies on this exact same claim. Second, whether there is not even a disputed fact as to Mr. Musazadeh's sincerity, even though there is significant evidence that he sincerely believes in consuming a kosher diet, and even though sincerity is a fact-specific inquiry that is not properly resolved on summary judgment. Finally, I will address TDCJ's argument that this court affirm on two alternative grounds not reached by the district court related to the substantial burden and strict scrutiny prongs of our LUPA. First, turning to exhaustion. The text of the Prison Litigation Reform Act explicitly says that exhaustion is a precursor to suit and not a continuing obligation once litigation has begun. This makes sense because, as this court discussed in
Yes. You're referencing a Texas statute, but aren't we dealing with the Prison Litigation Reform Act?
I'm sorry, it is the Prison Litigation Reform Act. And this makes sense because the court discussed in Johnson v. Johnson that the purpose of exhaustion is to provide fair notice of the inmate's claim and a fair opportunity for the prison to address the underlying problem that will form the basis of the lawsuit. Here it is undisputed that Mr. Musazadeh fully exhausted his remedies before filing suit. He filed two grievances in 2005 requesting that TDCJ provide him kosher food. TDCJ had an opportunity to respond. It took the position that it was not required to provide Mr. Musazadeh kosher food, and the parties have been litigating this same issue ever since. Yet TDCJ asserts that Mr. Musazadeh must re-exhaust his administrative remedies in light of changed factual circumstances. When Mr. Musazadeh filed his grievances, he was incarcerated at the Eastham unit, where kosher food was not provided. He was subsequently transferred to the Stringfellow unit and then on to the Stiles unit, where kosher food is available for purchase from the commissary. But these factual developments cannot require re-exhaustion. When even the district court has acknowledged that the core issue of Mr. Musazadeh's case remains the same, whether he is entitled to a permanent injunction for kosher food for the duration of his time in custody.
At the expense of the state of Texas?
Yes.
Well, he can purchase it at Stiles.
That's right.
You don't see a distinction in the exhaustion requirement between give it to me free, which is one aspect, or I'll pay for it in the commissary, or whatever they call it, which is another.
For purposes of exhaustion, his claim remains the same, that he should be provided kosher food in a prison dining hall, meaning in the same way that all other inmates receive their diets. And that was his claim, and TDCJ has even acknowledged that it knew that that was its claim in 2005 and remains its claim today. For instance, it filed a 28J letter with this court when Mr. Musazadeh was transferred to the Stiles unit where, as Your Honor mentioned, the prepackaged meals are available for purchase. TDCJ said that Mr. Musazadeh's claim was to be provided kosher food and that TDCJ did not provide kosher meals at any unit outside of the Stringfellow unit, and therefore his claim was no longer moot. So, and the district court, in addressing another issue in the same opinion as to whether Mr. Musazadeh was required to amend his complaint in light of the changed factual circumstance that kosher food is available for purchase at the commissary, stated that he did not need to amend his complaint because his claim remained the same, that TDCJ provide him a nutritionally sufficient kosher diet. That has been Mr. Musazadeh's request and claim from 2005, and it remains the same today. TDCJ needs no further notice of what Mr. Musazadeh is requesting here from it, and the purposes of exhaustion would not be served by requiring Mr. Musazadeh to jump through extra procedural hoops, require TDCJ to expend its resources to simply deny the same grievance that Mr. Musazadeh submitted in 2005, and then require Mr. Musaizadeh to file anew a lawsuit in district court after 7 years of litigating this claim.
Well, perhaps, though, if he filed it or refiled it, perhaps in the disciplinary process, evaluation could be made of all of his disciplinary infractions and how that bears on whether he is entitled to having it provided as it is provided at Stringfellow, where he was incarcerated before his disciplinary infractions resulted in his being transferred to Stiles.
The exhaustion process, I don't believe, would be the proper venue that to litigate or to explore those issues. As far as his disciplinary record, that and his ability to get transferred back to Stringfellow, TDCJ could simply transfer him back, and again, Mr. Musaizadeh's claim would remain the same.
Well, that he's looking for kosher his food. Refusal, I understood that he's been offered, to, and again, I don't know what is exactly in the record as it stands now, but he was offered a transfer back to Stringfellow and turned down the transfer.
He has not been offered a transfer. Mr. Musaizadeh, though, has not requested a transfer back to Stringfellow.
He has not what?
He was not offered a transfer back to Stringfellow. TDCJ does point out that during the few months that he was eligible for transfer back to Stringfellow, he did not make the formal request to be transferred back because he suffered abusive treatment from the guards there. However, Mr. Musaizadeh has currently started the process of requesting a transfer back to Stringfellow now that he is eligible.
It will moot this case.
Mr. Musaizadeh's position is that even if he was transferred back to Stringfellow, this case would not be moot because in order for a defendant to demonstrate mootness, they would have to establish that there is no reasonable chance that the alleged violation could recur again. Here, in light of Mr. Musaizadeh's transfers, TDCJ could not
might,
do so.
The reason it might happen again is because he'll have another disciplinary infraction. This can go on ad infinitum.
First of all, courts of appeals have held that the RLUIPA calculus is not affected by the fact that an inmate is denied an accommodation because of disciplinary infractions. Mr. Musaizadeh's disciplinary issues at TDCJ are not related to his sincere belief in and desire to consume kosher food.
But they resulted in his being transferred from Stringfellow to Stiles.
That's correct. But the way that this issue could be resolved is if TDCJ took the approach of 35 states and the Federal Bureau of Prisons and offered kosher food across units. There's no reason why TDCJ can't provide Mr. Musaizadeh prepackaged meals from the commissary at Stiles. In this way, TDCJ would be doing what nearly all the other states are doing, which is saying, regardless of your security classification, you can be provided kosher food. And this, it would create a circuit split for the Fifth Circuit to hold that the RLUIPA calculus is affected by an inmate's disciplinary record. TDCJ still needs to show that denying him kosher food, denying even someone of Mr. Musaizadeh's security classification who cannot reside at Stringfellow, to deny him kosher food is the least restrictive alternative. And based on the other alternatives that Mr. Musaizadeh has suggested to TDCJ, such as providing prepackaged meals from the Stringfellow kitchen, just transfer them over to the Stiles unit, providing prepackaged meals that are in the Stiles commissary for free, or provide him meals in the Stiles unit using butcher paper to make a kosher kitchen within a kitchen.
What is the distance from Stringfellow to Stiles?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that question.
That's a question. I mean, the fact that many other states, even a majority of the other states, mm-hmm. have this interpretation or provide this. Texas is tremendous geographic distance. So it may well be the case that they couldn't provide this in every unit, but the question whether it would be possible to provide it in most units or whatever is a different one. And that would have to be addressed. This is only filed on behalf of him.
That's right. It's not. class action. And TDCJ has established the stringfellow unit as well as four basic designated units is what they call these, which is the Stiles unit is one of those. So what they could do is just pick one of those units, for example, Stiles, or another one of the units, to provide kosher food to inmates who cannot be housed at Stringfellow. And that would do what California, a state that also is very large geographically, is able to do,
this doesn't seem to really matter very much. We know that they provide it on a daily basis and he can buy it. So it's there. In other words, there's nothing logistically impossible about having the proper food there every day.
That's correct.
The question is, if that's true, does he have to pay for it?
Does he have to pay for it? And under the substantial burden analysis this court has laid out in Atkins v. Caspar, it's clear that it is a substantial burden to force him to pay for that kosher food that is already present at the Stiles unit. What the court said in Atkins is that a substantial burden is any requirement that a inmate choose between a generally available non-trivial benefit and following his religious beliefs. Here, Mr. Musuzadeh cannot receive the non-trivial generally available benefit of a free diet and follow his beliefs in consuming kosher food. The other test that this court laid out in Atkins for a substantial burden is if a government regulation influences a prisoner's inclination to follow his religious beliefs. And here, you're requiring Mr. Musuzadeh to pay $5,000 each year to purchase three prepackaged kosher meals a day from the commissary. This would influence anyone's proclivity to follow their religious beliefs. So under this court's precedent in Atkins, TDCJ is imposing a substantial burden on Mr. Musuzadeh by asking him to pay for his meals and has not demonstrated that doing so satisfies the heightened scrutiny of strict scrutiny. ARLUPA imposes on TDCJ the highest level of scrutiny in any constitutional law, and TDCJ has not shown that it is furthering any compelling interests here in cost or security, and TDCJ has not shown that its current policy, which is providing inmates kosher foods at Stringfellow, but requiring them to purchase kosher meals if they're transferred outside of Stringfellow, is the least restrictive means of furthering those interests. For example, TDCJ has completely abandoned any argument that it cannot provide kosher food because of security reasons. Their 30B6 deponent stated that there have been absolutely no security issues whatsoever with providing inmates kosher food at Stringfellow or with making meals available at the commissary.
At the commissary at Stiles.
That's right. And the other, there are four basic designated units, Stiles and three others, where the meals are available
at
the commissary.
What is your understanding as to, as an officer of the court, your understanding as to the duration of this process to determine whether Mr. Musuzadeh will be transferred back to Stringfellow? What period of time are we talking about?
I actually am not sure. I know that he is going to start the process by meeting with a rabbi on October 16th, but I would defer to TDCJ to tell me how many months it would take to get him transferred back to Stringfellow. But again, our position would be that in light of the record here, there is no way that that would moot the question of whether he is entitled to kosher food for the duration of his custody.
He might commit another disciplinary violation and have to be transferred again.
TDCJ has also explained that he could be transferred if he needs certain medical attention.
Yeah, and there's a number of reasons.
Exactly, and that's what their policy states. And again, many other states, such as Colorado and California and the federal system, are able to provide kosher food to inmates regardless of whether they need to be transferred away from a single unit. Unless there are any other questions, I could briefly address sincerity, which is another issue. The First, Eighth, and Tenth Circuits have held that sincerity principally involves a credibility determination and is properly reserved for a fact finder at trial. Mr. Musuzadeh explained that he's Iranian Jewish, his desire for kosher food is a natural outgrowth of his Jewish upbringing, and because of this deep-rooted faith, he practices his Jewish religion during his time in TDCJ custody. prays three times a day with a daily prayer book, using a daily prayer shawl. He fasts on each of the Jewish full fast days.
Wasn't there some kind of an affidavit or something from a rabbi indicating that, from the prison rabbi indicating that he was, thought he was sincere? Yeah.
There was deposition testimony from the, from the prison rabbi, there was a declaration, and TDCJ's Jewish chaplain in his 30B6 testimony stated that he had never had any occasion to question Mr. Musizadeh's Jewishness. And under TDCJ's own policy, in order to be transferred to a designated unit, TDCJ's Jewish chaplain and Jewish outside authorities must determine that they determine their Jewishness or sincerity. There's never been any question since this process started in 2005 that Mr. Musizadeh was born of the Jewish faith and sincerely wants a kosher diet. The only evidence to the contrary is some commissary purchases that TDCJ have not even demonstrated are not kosher. And this court has held in precedent such as AAV Needville that evidence of backsliding cannot conclusively determine insincerity.
Okay, I think we have your argument. You've saved some time for rebuttal. Mr. DeAndrea.
May it please the court. Mr. Musizadeh refuses to confront the fact that strict scrutiny analysis is different for people in prison.
Mr. DeAndrea, does the state now contest this inmate's sincerity as to his desire to adhere to his Jewish faith by eating kosher?
Yes, Your Honor. We agree with the district court's finding that Mr. Musizadeh was not sincere in his...
And what is that based on?
It is based on his failure to prove... It is an element of his claim that he must prove that the religious practice in question, here eating kosher, is significant to him.
Well, but you're under no legal or ethical obligation to contest every element of his claim. You could concede that he is sincere for purposes of the case if you wanted to. I'm just wondering on what reasonable basis the state is contesting his sincerity. Why are you putting that in issue?
Because he failed to prove it, Your Honor, and because because of that failure to prove and his actions while he was in prison. For instance, after we transferred him to Stringfellow, at great expense to the state taxpayers, created a kitchen at Stringfellow and transferred him there. The record indicates that only about half the time did he actually go through the kosher kitchen line that we created for him. The other half of the time, he went to the regular line, which was not kosher. This went on for the entire time he was at Stringfellow.
So, back in the days when I was, when the church required you to eat fish on Friday, which thank God they don't, I don't think anymore, and I didn't. I was still not a devout Catholic, even though I went to Mass every day. Is that it?
Your Honor, I take your
the
point.
The end of it?
I think as the Seventh Circuit decision says, where would religion be without backsliders? And
that's me.
I completely agree, Your Honor, but the point is that taken with the fact that he didn't put in a single affidavit saying that keeping kosher is important to him, his failure to prove it, together with the circumstantial evidence, together with the fact that we are repeatedly told by the United States government that the way to control slippery slope costs is the fact that we can contest sincerity if the plaintiff fails to prove it, and here the plaintiff failed to prove it. And so we took it upon ourselves to contest it. And the trial court, who saw the plaintiff repeatedly, who was taken before the court several times, agreed with us. And we've quoted the paragraph from the trial court. And the trial court found that this was just about tormenting his captors, and he doesn't believe it at all.
About tormenting what?
I think the trial court's quote was tormenting the prison guards or his captors or something like that.
And that's an appropriate finding on summary judgment, you say?
No, Your Honor, it's not a finding. I'm sorry to use loose language. It is simply his failure to prove it. There is nothing in the record. He put in evidence that he was raised Jewish. But that's not what RLUIPA requires. RLUIPA requires proof that the practice is important to him. And there is nothing in the record, not an affidavit from his mother, not from his wife.
What about the deposition of one or more rabbis?
There might be some depo out there, but it's not in the record. The only thing in the record, and what their brief asks you to rely upon, is circumstantial evidence of the fact that TDCJ transferred him. So the way their argument works is this. TDCJ policy says there must be a finding of sincerity before they would have transferred him to Stringfellow, because that's what TDCJ's policy is. And therefore, the fact that we transferred him to Stringfellow is evidence that we conducted some kind of internal finding and found him sincere. And the problem with that is that might be true in the cases of most inmates. But in this case, we transferred him while a lawsuit was pending, pursuant to a settlement agreement. And CDCJ settles with inmates all the time, gives them what they want without any kind of finding of sincerity. In fact, usually, often we don't believe they're being sincere. But in any event, I'd like to turn to...
Tell us about the transfer process that's apparently been undertaken. How long will that, does that generally take? I know you can't give us a precise deadline, but...
Your Honor, I will file something with the court to give you precise deadlines. What I can tell you is this. He is not asked yet, and he is currently, as you know, the CCA granted him habeas relief, vacating one of his convictions, his murder conviction, and he is currently in plea talks. So the next steps are this is obviously outside of the record, but just to help the court, we assume there will be a guilty plea at some point, just because he's not really tested that. And then after that, if he ever requests the transfer, I assume it won't take long if his custodial status remains the same. And that's why I'm bringing up this guilty plea stuff. If he pleads to a lesser included, then perhaps his custodial status will be sufficiently low. We won't have to send him to maximum security. Then it should be pretty quick to get him to Stringfellow. I will file something with the court as soon as I know more. I'll give you something immediately after this argument, and then certainly if we know anything, we will keep the court apprised of that. I'd like to turn, I'd like to bracket the second question of whether TDCJ's current policy imposes a substantial burden on him, and jump first to that second part, which is whether that substantial burden, if any, is justified by the state's compelling interest in controlling costs and maintaining order. And the reason I'd like to jump to that is because that second question has already been answered by this court in Baranowski. In Baranowski and in later decisions, such as DeMoss v. Crane, this court has held that controlling costs is a compelling interest of its own in the prison context. So Baranowski, the background of Baranowski is also critical to understanding this dispute. TDCJ's past policy was it had no kosher meals at all. It only provided meat-free, vegetarian, pork-free meals, and then the regular meals. TDCJ, and this court in Baranowski upheld that and said that was justified out of TDCJ's concern for costs. Despite that holding, TDCJ implemented a less restrictive alternative, and that was to provide it free for most of its inmates at Stringfellow, and then for a fee for its most dangerous inmates who it couldn't transfer to Stringfellow. So because of those concerns for cost and security that this court credited in Baranowski, TDCJ stopped short of providing those free kosher meals. They decided that it was a step too far, and that is the step that the plaintiff is asking this court to take.
But well, that's relative to what the additional cost would be, is it? Are you saying that any cost whatsoever at Stringfellow would be a compelling interest?
To answer that in the abstract, yes, Your Honor, any cost is a compelling interest, and then this court has to address the question of whether those costs compounded by concerns such as slippery slopes are enough of a compelling interest in whatever context you're talking about. Now, here, no.
Well, I think Ms. Robinson mentions that just providing a butcher paper to separate the foods during preparation would be sufficient. I seem to remember something in the record about maybe just providing a separate microwave oven and a separate burner might be sufficient. It sounds relatively insignificant to me to satisfy the compelling interest test.
Well, let me give you two answers to that, if you will, Your Honor. The first is what he's asking for has been a bit of a moving target. If you look at his complaint, he says that there is no such thing as halfway kosher, requires full kosher, or there's no kosher at all. We have hired a rabbi who has been consulting with TDCJ, and maybe this is too technical for, it's true that 85% of American Jews don't eat in this sort of very strict way, but that, according to him, that would not be sufficient. And in any event, he never really was asking for that. For the longest time, this was about building kosher kitchens at all the units in TDCJ. And now it's sort of, there's the suggestion that maybe it would be enough to give him food off the line or with a butcher paper. And my second answer to that, Your Honor, is even that, the TDCJ has considered those alternatives at this point. And even that is one step further than the agency was willing to go and thinks that it's appropriate to go based on its concerns for cost and security.
I mean, it does seem to me that Ms. Robinson has conceded that the butcher paper option would be sufficient. I mean, we can consider that as not really a concession, but as an agreement. So why don't you address in a little bit more detail how that possibly could be enough of an additional cost that the state would have a compelling interest?
Yes, Your Honor. First, the security costs. He's asking us to play favorites at our most dangerous prisons. In a maximum security prison, to single out certain inmates and to give them better food. Second, costs. This court in Baranowski held, and the Supreme Court has held, that courts must consider slippery slope issues in the prison context. Baranowski credited TGJ's concern that kosher meals would breed resentments among other inmates and there would be increased demands from other religious groups for similar diets. The slippery slope costs are very real, Your Honor. The Americans...
Well, that already exists at Stiles, right?
It already exists at Stringfellow, which is a very small prison, a very small prison where it's cabined. What he's asking for is us to provide this in all of our big maximum security prisons system-wide. So I want to leave, Your Honor, this case is not about...
What I don't understand is you are able to provide kosher food in a package for him to buy. So you're able to provide kosher food in a package in the Stiles unit, and you've costed that out. You know what that involves. So all he's saying is, let me have the package without having to pay for it.
Right, which would both.
That's what this case reduces to, isn't it?
It seems that is the point we're at now, but that still raises the same cost and security concerns that I've been discussing, Your Honor. I mean, that is why the American Sikhs and the American Islamic Congress did not hire Perkins Coie to appear before you as amicus so that one inmate in Huntsville could get kosher meals. This case is all about greasing slippery slopes. This is not a case about $3,000. I think if we have to provide free special meals across the TDCJ system in all our maximum security prisons, it's only a matter of time before everyone starts requesting it. And those are the cost and security concerns that animate TDCJ's policy in saying we're going to build a small kosher kitchen at a small prison outside of Houston and we can go no further. In any event, Your Honor, even putting those security concerns aside, Mr. Misadat has not shown, he has not proven at all, that he can't afford to just buy the meals. This court requires that an inmate show, on a case-by-case basis, it evaluates whether there's a substantial burden. And you must show that it's truly pressured him to substantially change it. And he has no evidence that he hasn't even attempted to show that our policy of making him buy these meals would impose a substantial burden on him. For instance, some California prisons, which he holds out as an example for TDCJ to follow, are charging their inmates hundreds of dollars a month just for room and board. And if the inmates don't pay, they slap a lien on their house when they get out. And this is a far cry from what TDCJ is doing here. We're just asking him, at least what he's suggested now would suffice, which is just buying a few of these meals, and he says that it's not that much. He hasn't proven that he can't do that himself. And
so if this were a plaintiff that didn't have any money, it would be a different case.
It would be a different case, Your Honor. I think then it would be a much closer, more difficult case. That would be, but the question of substantial burden has to be relative. It is relative to the plaintiff asserting the harm. And so it can't just be that any economic burden is substantial, right? Take a Catholic inmate who we charged 15 cents for a communion wafer. I mean, I know that's a sacrament and not food. But same thing, if this Catholic inmate were very rich, I think you couldn't come in and say, well, this is a substantial burden on my religious practice. So there must be some line to draw. It's a relative inquiry. You must look at both the means of the inmate and the cost we're asking them to incur. And here he has not even attempted to show that he can't afford it. And in fact, the evidence points the other way. He has substantial account balance in his trust.
I'm sure there are cases in this area that look at the means of the inmate. You know, there are cases. You can cite a case for any proposition under the sun and for its opposite. But what is your case that says that it's fair to consider the on something like what I'm going to have to eat for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, that you can consider the means of the inmate.
Your Honor, the Eighth Circuit case we cited in our brief discusses, it rejects one of these claims saying there's no showing that he's indigent. I think the Tenth Circuit cases that they cite are similar. They grant relief, but because they show that there's no money in these people's trust accounts and that they are basically indigent.
Were these cases, and I'm just asking you because I don't know which cases you're referring to, are these cases that involve something as basic as food? Or
These are all food cases, Your Honor. And so I think those cases in particular seem to turn on the question of indigence, which isn't terribly satisfying, but is at least a bright line that this Court's familiar with. It's an inquiry the Court makes all the time in prisoner cases. I think probably something more subtle might be in order in some cases, but that seems to be where some of these cases come down. There's a Seventh Circuit case cited by Baranowski, which is also in our brief, Andriola, that rejects a food claim as well, something similar. It's $3,000 or $4,000 would be the annual cost, and the Seventh Circuit credits the state's important, compelling interest in controlling the cost of prisoner upkeep, and they reject the claim that the state is required to spend that $3,000, and that case was relied upon by this Court in Baranowski. I'd like to talk a little bit about exhaustion then with the time I have left. Exhaustion is determined in reference to state law, and state law requires that inmates be very specific on their forms. That is a different pleading requirement than required by the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, which just asks to put us on fair notice. And the plaintiff here complained that he was being forced to eat non-kosher food because he did not have access to it. So that is a very different complaint. He's no longer being forced to eat kosher food because he does have access to it for purchase in the commissary. So that's not really giving us a fair opportunity to address his claims. And particularly,
well, what would you do in addressing his claims? Are you suggesting you might give him relief on a disciplinary claim?
I'm not saying it's likely, but it's certainly possible. We've already settled with him once. I think throughout this litigation, what he's asking for has become a bit of a moving target. Yes, I think it's possible. We would certainly like to at least pin him down on exactly what he's asking for. Would butcher paper suffice? Do you really want us to buy this? Do you want to transfer to Stringfellow? All these things could be sorted out in this kind of dispute. Before he was asking, I mean, early in the case in the record, he says he wants a certified kitchen, and he refused to be transferred to Stringfellow until we had brought someone in to certify that the kitchen was kosher. And now he seems to suggest that he'd be happy to just take a prepackaged meal at Stringfellow and then maybe go grab some green beans off the main line, none of which was kosher before and didn't suffice before. So I think these are the sorts of issues we could work out. It's also possible, when he filed his original complaint, he thought that there were caps on his ability to buy kosher food. We've shown that there are not. He hasn't put in any evidence to the contrary. That's something else we might work out. So I think there might be something, there's certainly something to be gained as far as tightening up the record for re-exhausting, and I think it's definitely possible that we come up with something, as evidenced by the fact that we've settled with him once before.
How about addressing, for want of a better term, waiver of claims due to disciplinary infractions?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The plaintiff's waiving various claims, or the argument that he could have waived certain claims because of his disciplinary infractions. For example, he was at Stringfellow. He got a kosher kitchen. But because of his own actions, disciplinary infractions, he was transferred to Stiles, maximum security, where there is no kosher kitchen. So how about addressing that, your view of possibly he's waived these claims?
I think it's certainly true that most of the confusion in this case is the plaintiff's own doing. There is some case law suggesting that, where there is a sort of full-throated right, then it doesn't matter where you are. But here, it does matter to both the substantial burden analysis and to the point of whether this is narrowly tailored. I think that. And certainly the equities are against him in that regard, that he did not, that this is all his kind of own doing is the reason he got transferred back. And I think particularly where he's asking this court to fashion some sort of ongoing remedy, the PLRA would prevent and counsel against, certainly, the court issuing something like that, some kind of permanent injunction that lasts forever that said no matter what he did, even if he were in solitary, even if then we would have to bring him, I guess we would have to keep him at Stringfellow to provide this food.
Tell us, as an officer of the court, if you know, what are the provisions for adding to one's trust account? Are there limitations on that? Can friends and relatives contribute any amount? Is there a certain amount for work at the prison that's put into the trust account?
There are – friends and relatives can contribute. In fact, that is –
limit or – I'm just trying to get some picture of this $5,000 a year and how that would work, because you have mentioned trust accounts several times.
I will file something to tell you exactly what the limits on external deposits are. I don't think there are any. I don't know of any. There are a lot of restrictions, but they're mostly to prevent sort of inmates making money off practicing law or selling drugs. So there are certainly restrictions on, you know, we often discipline prisoners for someone else's mother will deposit, you know, if they do legal work for a friend, and then that friend's mother deposits money in their account. Those are sort of forbidden accounts. But his money certainly comes from, some of it came from his parents and his wife. And so I know that's permitted, but I will report back to the court for any kind of, if there's a cap on it at all.
Okay, I think we have your argument. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. First of all, to address TDCJ's discussion of sincerity, where TDCJ said that there was nothing in the record on whether Mr. Musazadeh sincerely wants kosher food, tabs 4 and tab 6 of your record excerpts contain his grievances and his declarations explaining that he was born Iranian Jewish, educated in Jewish schools, and his request for kosher food is a natural outgrowth of his upbringing, and he sincerely does want kosher food. On the substantial burden issue and whether indigence or some sort of evidence as a cap of how much money he has would be an issue here, cases such as Beerhide in the Tenth Circuit clearly state that indigence is not relevant here in the substantial burden inquiry. In that case, the charge that Colorado's prison system was proposing to make on its inmates was only $90 a month. That's far less than the $5,000 a year at issue here. The court noted that each of the inmates, there was a group of them, had more than $90 a month in their commissary accounts, but still found that requiring someone to pay $90 a month for their diet was a substantial burden under the Tenth Circuit's analysis. And this court in Atkins certainly does not discuss a distinction based on the amount that the inmate is willing to pay. The third point is that Mr. Musazadeh has only had, the record evidence shows that he has had at most half that amount in his commissary account at any one time and has spent less than half that amount in a two-year period. So it is not clear that Mr. Musazadeh could afford to pay $5,000 every year in order to consume kosher food. Lastly, on the TDCJ mentioned that there is an issue on providing kosher food related to resentment, envy amongst inmates, and a slippery slope argument. There's absolutely nothing in this record on those issues. In fact, their 30B6 deponent, Mr. Morales, on security issues, stated that there have been no problems related to resentment or envy in offering kosher food at the commissaries or at Stringfellow, and TDCJ completely abandoned that argument on summary judgment. TDCJ cannot now resurrect that argument here. The case law and strict scrutiny clearly holds that a declaration stating their security interests involved is not sufficient to satisfy strict scrutiny. This court mentioned in AA v. Neatville that a prison must come, or a defendant must come forth with specific credible evidence about the issue in order to satisfy strict scrutiny. And the Supreme Court has recently held that a slippery slope argument, which TDCJ mentioned that term several times, is insufficient to satisfy strict scrutiny unless there is specific evidence of slippery slope concerns on the record here. They mentioned in their briefs that additional inmates might request halal diets and other diets, but there is absolutely no record evidence of those requests in this case. And those questions were specifically asked, and the answer was, no, there's no evidence that that might happen. So that TDCJ cannot use those arguments to satisfy strict scrutiny.
What Supreme Court case?
That was, I will file something with the court.
You can just write it on Central paper and give it to
Okay, thank you. And lastly, on the Baranowski case, Baranowski does not foreclose the relief Mr. Musazadeh is requesting here. As the Supreme Court held in Gonzales v. Ocentro and Cutter v. Wilkinson, this is a claim-by-claim, case-by-case inquiry. Here the record is very different from Baranowski. Baranowski, there was uncontroverted summary judgment evidence. The plaintiff, who's pro se, put forth no evidence whatsoever on any cost or security concerns. And TDCJ at that point said that because of those cost and security concerns, it could not provide kosher food to any inmate. Now we have a record where TDCJ has been providing kosher food to inmates without any problems for 7 years. And TDCJ has abandoned any security argument here because there was no record evidence to support it. Moreover, as we've discussed at length today, Mr. Musazadeh has offered several less restrictive alternatives to accommodate Mr. Musazadeh's request for kosher food. TDCJ has not considered those alternatives and therefore cannot satisfy strict scrutiny.
And how has he provided those alternatives?
He's asked during deposition testimony during the settlement procedures back in 2007.
Doesn't that play into the fact that perhaps he ought to file a new disciplinary, he ought to have to go back and exhaust again and let him know what he's willing to accept?
Mr. Musazadeh has let TDCJ know. TDCJ
has in
the
formal process, not what he might say on a deposition.
What TDCJ's rules require in the grievance process is only that a plaintiff put forth the facts related to their requested relief. So all his grievance would be permitted to say under TDCJ's own rules is that he now resides at the Stiles unit and that he's requesting that kosher food be provided to him in the dining
process,
hall.
It might be that they would then say to him, well, what do you think is necessary? And the disciplinary process might really serve a useful function and perhaps bring all of this to an end.
We've been litigating this case, as Your Honor is noting, for several years, and we have, in that litigation process, suggested that TDCJ provide Mr. Musazadeh the kosher meals for free. They have rejected that suggestion and have never suggested in their briefing or otherwise that they are inclined to provide Mr. Musazadeh those prepackaged meals for
free. The inmates running the prison, that's what you're suggesting here, that you have suggested to the prison system what they ought to do. Maybe we ought to just follow the disciplinary or grievance procedures that are set up and let that run its course rather than counsel telling the Texas Department of Corrections what they ought to do.
There are two different inquiries here. There's the grievance procedures, which are to provide fair notice of what the inmate is requesting. And I agree with Your Honor. It would be presumptuous for Mr. Musazadeh in a grievance where he's supposed to be just providing fair notice to TDCJ of what he's requesting to provide them all the different alternatives. However, under strict scrutiny, turning to that analysis, which the ARLUPA statute lays out and has provided that strict scrutiny is what TDCJ must demonstrate here, it specifically requests under that case law that the plaintiff provide or offer less restrictive means for the defendant to consider. And if the defendant has not adequately considered and explained why it cannot adopt the less restrictive means, which 35 states in the federal prison system have adopted, providing kosher food to inmates across units, they cannot satisfy strict scrutiny. And that is a situation we have here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We call the next case for the